This is London calling North America.
The British Broadcasting Corporation presents London Letter by MacDonald Hastings. This week, MacDonald Hastings describes the welcome and tribute which General Eisenhower received from the people of London.
This is MacDonald Hastings from London.
Just over 25 years ago, I watched the Supreme Allied Commander of the last war ride in triumph through the streets of London. A small boy though I was, the military pageantry of it all so affected me. The occasion was so consciously dramatic that I thought I should never see anything quite like it again. Even now, I can remember standing in the window of one of the government offices in Whitehall and seeing Foch, in all the glory of the uniform of a Marshal of France, Foch mounted on a beautiful bay charger, riding at the head of the victory march of Allied troops. The flags were out, the bands were playing, and the air was ringing with the chink of harness and the rattle of swords. As Foch passed the cenotaph, I can see it all in my mind's eye now. With superb horsemanship, Foch reared his charger onto its hind legs, and with his horse's forefeet pawing the air, the commander-in-chief gave his solemn salute to the Allied dead. It was a tremendous, thrilling moment. But it wasn't so moving or so heart-filling as a very unmilitary ceremony in London the other day, when a boyish-looking soldier from Kansas, with a big grin and a deprecating manner, came to the center of the British Empire to receive his tribute from people, city, and sovereign. From the King, he received the Order of Merit, one of the highest and rarest honors which Britain can bestow. From the city, he received the Freedom of London, and then added his name to the golden list of the great men of recorded history. And from the people of London, this son of America received a tribute such as no foreigner in this proud city has ever had before. The people of London came out on their streets, leaned out of their windows, climbed onto their balconies and roofs, and pinned their hearts to the broad chest of the first soldier of the war. There was no guard of honor, no bands, no pomp or circumstance. Nothing to stir the heart with easy emotion. The supreme commander of the Allied armies drove through the streets of London as modestly as one of his own GIs. And he waved at the cheering crowds and laughed with the same high spirits as one of his own GIs come up to London to see the sights. And the effect was tremendous. Here was one of the greatest soldiers in history, following the triumphal route that so many great soldiers in history have taken before him. But this soldier came not as a proud conqueror, not as the representative of a tight-laced, stiff-lipped military caste. Eisenhower, returning victorious from the greatest campaign in the history of war, drove into the city of London with his deputy, Air Marshal Tedder, to hold his hand, and a handful of mounted police to prevent the crowd wringing his hand off him. I saw him arrive in an anonymous-looking staff car at the boundary of the city of London. I ought to tell you that what we call the City of London is now only a small part of London proper. It's the original city before London spread over hundreds of square miles. And under the authority of the Lord Mayor, the City of London still preserves many of its ancient rights and privileges, wrested in times past by the citizens from the early kings. For instance, even now, the King mayn't cross Temple Bar, which is the site of the old city gates, without the express invitation of the Lord Mayor. And to this day, when the King comes to the city on a ceremonial visit, he still stops at Temple Bar to await the invitation of the Lord Mayor to come in. The City of London has its own police, its own law courts, and even the King's soldiers mustn't carry arms in the city without permission of the Lord Mayor. And to be given the freedom of the City of London, as General Eisenhower has been, is an honour which is still one of the most exalted honours that Britain can give. When General Eisenhower signed the Roll of Fame with his flowing signature, he added his name to a list which I think I'm right in saying only three Americans have signed before: General Ulysses Grant, Theodore Roosevelt, and General Pershing. When General Eisenhower arrived at Temple Bar, he was welcomed by the chief of the city police.
An open horse-drawn carriage awaited him, and after a handshake, the General with Air Marshal Tedder climbed in for the traditional drive down Fleet Street, the center of Britain's newspapers, past St. Paul's to the bomb-damaged Guildhall. The crowd had already given a tremendous cheer to Mr. and Mrs. Churchill, who passed by a few minutes before. But it was General Eisenhower's day, and hundreds of thousands of city workers out of their office for the midday break lined the streets, cheering and shouting good old Ike to the laughing, waving general lounging comfortably in the back seat of a carriage. Along the way, I saw a British soldier have a show all to himself. He'd climbed on top of a bomb-ruined building, and as the supreme commander, his commander, passed by, the soldier sprang stiffly to attention. General Eisenhower immediately turned and saluted. The crowd roared. At Guildhall, under a temporary boarded roof between headless statues, scars of the Blitz, the city fathers in all their state gathered in procession in the historic and gallant old hall. Carried at the head of the procession were the sword and the mace, symbols of the City of London's independence and power. Behind came the Lord Mayor of London in full robes, heavily braided and embroidered. And with him, in a great splash of colour, came the wigged, fur-capped and gaily liveried city attendants and officials. On the floodlit dais, three banners pierced the city arms. The Union Jack on one side, the City of London's flag on the other, and the Star and Stripes proudly between them. The damaged hall was peopled from wall to wall. They formed a solid square between the statues. They rose in a block of colour up the tiered seats to the minstrel's gallery, where a military band was playing American folk songs and old patriotic melodies of other wars. When the scene was set, the master of ceremonies announced one by one the distinguished guests. Their names alone were a tribute to General Eisenhower. 12 members of the British cabinet, including Mr. Churchill, 16 ministers, 3 ex-ministers, official representatives of both houses of parliament, dignitaries of the church led by the Archbishop of Canterbury, the heads of the 3 fighting services, 3 members of the royal household, Dominion's representatives and delegates of the city companies, the great financial and business corporations of London, learned societies, and finally 40 of General Eisenhower's colleagues in chief, and more than 40 from the American embassy led by Mr. Wynand. When the notabilities were introduced and seated, the band began to play the battle hymn of the Republic. The cheering sank to an expectant rustle, and the musicians played more and more softly. Suddenly there was a sharp command outside, and into the assembly, pleased, embarrassed, proud, walked General Eisenhower. A clerk gave the traditional cry of order, order, and the Court of Common Council, as it's called, was in session for one of the most historic occasions in its historic existence. General Eisenhower signed the roll of fame. Then the Chamberlain offered him the right hand of fellowship and asked him to accept a sword of honor from the Lord Mayor. General Eisenhower, he said, can't be in any doubt about the emotions he has aroused among all classes in this country. Yet there is one welcome with which his reception in this country would be incomplete. The welcome of this ancient city, the heart of the British Empire. General Eisenhower's own sword of state wasn't ready for the ceremony. But instead, the city made him a gesture which I think was even more appropriate. The Lord Mayor handed the greatest general of our time the sword of the greatest general of the last century. Sword that Wellington wore at the Battle of Waterloo. Then Eisenhower made that wonderful speech which already everybody is comparing with Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. The next memorable part of the day's events was a luncheon at the Mansion House. That's the Lord Mayor's official residence. And it was then that General Eisenhower appeared on the balcony with Mr. Churchill and told the crowd, whether you know it or not, I'm now a Londoner myself. How the Londoners loved him for that. Even more, perhaps, than America, for the past year, the destiny of London and Britain has been in Eisenhower's hands. If he'd failed, God knows what the consequences for us would have been. In victory, London asked nothing more than that the man whose sword stood between us and the enemy should share a little of his heart with us. When he went into luncheon at the Mansion House, Eisenhower, heaven knows where he got it, was trying to hide in an embarrassed way a bouquet of English roses which somebody had given him behind his back. At the state luncheon, the city's gold plate gleamed opulently on the table. Waitresses in black and white uniforms moved among the guests. Although an hour or more had passed since Eisenhower spoke from the balcony, the cheers of the crowd were wafted in through the open windows all during the meal. After lunch, General Eisenhower made another speech, his third. And this time he dropped formal tones of his Guildhall speech for an easy drawl. You know what he said, how he talked of Anglo-American relations with the fervor of a crusader, but it was typical of him that he mentioned his colleagues, Cunningham, Montgomery, Tedder, Alexander, more than himself. Another great crowd waited to cheer Eisenhower home. And as one of my colleagues wrote, the broad smile, the wide-set eyes, the southern drawl, the lanky, canson gait, they all made up a portrait of humble greatness which warmed the people to the leader of the Allied forces. In the evening, the King at Buckingham Palace made the general a member of the Order of Merit, the first United States soldier to be given the honor. The order is confined to 24 British members with the addition of honorary foreign members. It's conferred for exceptionally meritorious service by men or women towards the advancement of art, literature, and science, or in the services. Afterwards, the general had tea with the king and then went to be received by the Queen Mother. One of the fullest days of his life ended with dinner at No. 10 Downing Street with the Prime Minister. I've described the occasion to you inadequately, I'm afraid. I've described it to you first because it reveals Eisenhower not only as a great soldier, but as a very great man. And second, because the occasion in London was really the climax, the outward evidence of the link which has been hammered between our two countries in this war. General Eisenhower is first and last an American general. But he's our general too. Under his command, British soldiers have fought and died. Under his command, British and Americans have learnt to work and fight together. And under Eisenhower's command, we've learnt to admire and appreciate America and Americans as never before. He's your man, but we share in him your pride. Till next week. Goodbye.
You have been listening to a recording of London Letter by MacDonald Hastings.